Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 1st of March. The readings at Mass during Lent concentrate into 6 weeks practically all the material you need to make sense of Christianity. This is good for the adults who are going to be baptized at Easter, because this Lent is, after all, their final period of training and preparation. It's their intense revision time. It's also good for us already Christians, because if we aren't given a jolt from time to time, we get so used to our Christian belief that it turns into just a nice label, an identity. A concentrated course of where it all comes from is just what we need to bring us back to life again, and for the belief within us to come alive too and start bearing fruit. Either way, instead of weekly readings spread over the 52 weeks of the year, we get daily readings crammed into the 6 weeks of Lent. It's like boiling down the stock you made from goose bones into a really intense goose sauce. If that doesn't wake you up, I don't know what will. Not everyone has a daily missal, but all of you have Universalis, at least I hope so, so you can read or listen to the readings every day. This week alone we have Judge Not Lest You Be Judged on Monday, Practice What You Preach on Tuesday, Dives at Lazarus on Thursday, The Prodigal Son on Saturday. Every one of these Gospels could be a suitable Sunday reading, a hinge on which the whole week turns, and every one of them does turn up on a Sunday at one time or another in the Church's year. Here is Lent, packing them all in close proximity, a new one of them every day. If you look at the readings for the Sundays of Lent with a critical eye, they do all seem to be appropriately Lenten, as indeed they ought, but there's one exception. This second Sunday of Lent, the 1st of March, we have the Transfiguration of the Lord. With all its light and glory, it doesn't seem Lenten at all. I'm not the only one to be puzzled by this. There was an exhibition last year at the National Gallery in London on the rise of painting in the city of Siena between 1300 and 1350. One of the stars of the show was the predella, that is, the row of paintings at the base of the back of the magnificent, huge high altar of the cathedral at Siena. The whole thing was painted by the Sienese artist Duccio between 1308 and 1311. The front of the high altar was for Mass, of course, and all the ceremonies went on in front of that side of the altar, but you could get round to the back, where it was quiet and enclosed. You could get yourself up close to one of the paintings along the base and get swallowed up by the scene it showed. You could lose yourself in it and lose yourself in prayer. I even read somewhere that the cathedral accounts show a regular payment for a candle to be placed behind the high altar so that people could see those pictures better. That glorious high altar was taken down in 1505 and put away, and over the centuries the predella paintings were sold off piece by piece. The National Gallery has some of them, and what they were particularly proud of in this exhibition was that they had managed to borrow the other known ones, so that they were able to exhibit all together in the way they once were 8 of the 9 paintings which the people of Siena had been able to venerate for so many years. So, if you had to commission 9 paintings for people to look at, what would you choose? The theme was to be the life of Christ after the Nativity and before the Passion. Here is what they chose. The first painting we don't know about. It has gone missing and never been found. It must either have been the Baptism of Christ or the First Temptation in the Wilderness. The second and third paintings are the second and third temptations of Christ in the wilderness, the pinnacle of the temple and the kingdoms of the world. Those are familiar to us because we had them last Sunday. The next two paintings are the Calling of the Apostles and the Wedding at Cana. Those are familiar to us as well. They belong to a couple of the Sundays between the Baptism of the Lord and the beginning of Lent. The 6th, 7th and 9th paintings are the Samaritan Woman, the Man Born Blind and the Raising of Lazarus. These are going to be the themes of the 3 Lenten Sundays starting from next week, the 8th. I have left the 8th painting till last, but the way I have told the story, you should have worked out by now what it is. That painting comes from the Gospel for this Sunday. It is the Transfiguration. Now, the art historian who wrote this part of the exhibition catalogue was puzzled by the inclusion of the Transfiguration. She pointed out that it was not a liturgical feast in the Western Church at the time, so why was it painted there on the predella? I checked, and she's right. Our familiar feast on the 6th of August wasn't decreed universally until 1456 to celebrate the defeat of the Turks at Belgrade. It is indeed a puzzle. That is to say, the art experts are puzzled, but we aren't. We know that the other predella paintings all belong to the beginning of the year plus Lent. The Transfiguration is commemorated in Lent. End of puzzle. We ordinary Christians have just solved an art historical puzzle, but our own puzzle remains. What is so Lenten about the Transfiguration that has made it something we focus on in Lent on the second Sunday for at least the past 800 years? What have all that brightness and glory to do with penitential gloom? Here are two keys to it. The first key is that in the story of the Transfiguration in the Gospel, when the light has gone and the apostles have Jesus back again, the ordinary Jesus, their Jesus, the story doesn't end there. The story finishes with Jesus telling the apostles not to tell anyone about what they have seen until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. The second key is that the apostles of the Transfiguration are the apostles of Gethsemane, Peter, James, and John. What the Transfiguration is a sort of immunisation against Gethsemane. When they went up the mountain, Peter, James, and John knew Jesus as a teacher. They knew him as a healer and a miracle worker. Now, in some sense of the word know, they must have known deep down that Jesus was much more than that. But that deep down kind of knowledge, when it comes to the crunch, you don't always trust. I don't know if it's ever happened to you, that you trust your friend, and then something happens that seems to contradict that, and you feel yourself wanting to say, I trust you, I judge you to be trustworthy, but I don't quite trust my own judgment. The apostles could easily have felt that at Gethsemane, and during what happened after Gethsemane. Two things could keep them sane, and we are commemorating them both this Sunday. One was those words about the Son of Man being raised from the dead. After the Transfiguration, they had been wondering what those words meant. At Gethsemane, at the end of all things, they still didn't know what they meant, but they knew they meant something, and that something was hope. That was the intellect. But we don't only think with our minds. We think with our eyes as well. The mind is able to deceive itself, as we know, but the eyes only observe, they don't interpret. So the eyes tell the truth. In their time of trouble, when their minds didn't know how to carry on believing anything of what at one time they had thought was beyond all doubt, the eyes of the apostles of Gethsemane were still the eyes of the apostles of the Transfiguration, and those eyes were repeating obstinately, never mind what is going on now. What we saw up on the mountain, we saw. That's the Transfiguration for the apostles. What about the rest of us? My favourite answer begins with a pagan myth. Semele, a daughter of Cadmus, was beloved of Zeus, king of the gods, who would visit her in the shape of a young man. Hera, the wife of Zeus, was jealous and resolved to destroy Semele. She took the form of Semele's old nurse and persuaded her to make Zeus show himself not as a young man, but as what he truly was, a god, in storms, thunder, and lightning. Semele asked, Zeus had to do it, and so Semele was reduced to smouldering ashes. God the Son was truly God. He was the power which had created the universe and which gave it its being. Incarnate as a first-century Jew, and given the name Jesus, he was still God. So the picture I get now is of the Son holding himself in, wrapping himself deeply in the human nature he's taken on, protecting the apostles from a power too great for them to survive. And at the Transfiguration, up on the mountain, he let just a little of what he was shine through. It must have been so carefully calibrated to turn down the attenuation very slightly so the apostles would see something, but turn it down only very slightly, because what the Lord said to Moses is still true. Man cannot see me and live. We are made in God's image. Therefore, we too have a light within us. It's not much of a light, and we cover it quite effectively, what with shyness and sin, but it is there, and just sometimes we are given the gift to see it in others. Whether we see it or not, it is always there. As Julian of Norwich says, "In every soul that shall be saved is a godly will that never assented to sin, nor ever shall. It may be buried deep inside us, but it is there. When you get a glimpse of it in someone else, remember that moment." Not all that much time left, but I want to point you to the Gospel of this Monday, because I want to contradict it. All right, let's be more respectful. I want to contradict the meaning that some people give to it. The passage is this: "Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned." We know these words so well, or we think we do, that we come to misunderstand them, and that is dangerous. The misunderstanding is when you take "do not judge" to mean literally "do not judge." If you literally do that, then lying, stealing, adultery, murder, all these actions must be neither good nor bad, since Jesus told you not to judge them. If you literally follow that, then even if someone else does something obviously bad to you, you mustn't judge the action or call it bad. All of which is clearly nonsense. When someone steals your bicycle, you do not welcome the opportunity to wallow in a warm pool of unjudgmentality. You want your bike back. Nobody can really live life on the principle of "do not judge." If you are indifferent to bicycles, what if it isn't a possession of yours but something human? Suppose that someone proposes to go and make your young child drunk. Will you really not judge that? So the misunderstood sense must be the wrong one, and indeed no one does live by it. All the same, "do not judge" must mean something because Jesus said it, and it must mean something true because Jesus wouldn't have said it if it wasn't. I think the distinction is between judging acts and judging people. We must never say, "this is a bad person," and this for two reasons. First, simply because of the word "bad." God created all things good, God created mankind, and so no human being can be bad. Second, because the phrase "a bad person" has the word "a" in it, and "a" is the most dangerous word in the English language. To call someone "a" is to put that person in a box with a label on it, and then to take the label as the only reality. There is no longer an individual called into existence by God in his infinite wisdom and love. There is no longer an individual tangled up in an intricate net of friendship, enmity, loves, hates, and desires, the way we all are. None of that. To call someone "a" is to call that person not human. God calls each of us by name, and my name is not "a." So much for judging people and calling people good or bad. But acts can be bad acts. You and I know that because you and I have done them, although you and I are not bad people. Bad acts done by good people are called sins, and sin is the great liberating doctrine of the Church, very nearly the greatest gift she has to give the world. A friend of mine told me a story once which touches on the distinction between act and person and illuminates it. My friend was working on a building site. We think of builders as rough, uncultured people, and so, taken as a group, they are. But they are loving people as well, as we shall see. They already knew that they had to be, to some extent, because think about it. People who spend all day with lethal sledgehammers, shovels, saws, and other weapons of destruction must have some way of getting on with one another, or otherwise by the end of the day no one would be left alive. Many builders on many sites are there purely because the money is good. In all the dust, dirt, and danger, the money is what keeps them going, and more often than not that is because they are fathers. They have come here from a country far away, because here they can earn more and send it all home so that their wives and children can eat and have somewhere to live. They themselves, meanwhile, live in appalling conditions and half-starve themselves so that their families can live. Nowadays they all have phones, so at least they can see their children on the screen and communicate with them that way, though sometimes you wonder whether better isn't worse, seeing your children there inside that blank rectangle and knowing that you can't meet them or touch them or smell their hair, and that by the time you do manage to visit, each child will be older and the child you are seeing on the screen today will no longer exist. Even with the rough accommodation they have to live in, even though the plumbing is not all it ought to be, still builders manage to keep themselves clean after a fashion, until one day one of them didn't. After a day or two, he smelt. A few days later, he began to smell really bad, so that even in those huge open ironwork lifts they have on big building sites, taking the same lift with him became intolerable. And then my friend said to this man the kindest thing you could possibly imagine. He said, "You stink." He added something like this, "Come round and have a shower and let's put your clothes in the washing machine." Now a properly non-judgmental person would have respected that man's lifestyle choice and not interfered with it, but my friend knew enough to distinguish between the state and the person. If you wanted to put it in elegant and precise words, you could say that he distinguished between a man who is dirty and a dirty man. Because after all, you can rightly judge a state without judging the person who is in that state. Indeed, the only thing you need to judge the action or state and not the person is love. And loving is something anybody at all can do, people of advanced education and people of none. Yes, sometimes "you stink" is the most loving thing anybody could ever possibly say. It means you matter enough for me to say this to you. Or more shortly, it means you matter. Or more shortly still, you exist. I don't know what happened next, or what the cause behind it all was in the first place. It could have been depression, or despair, or self-hatred. It could have been accumulated homesickness, the long, long being away from the only people who make your life worthwhile. The devil has many ways into our lives. But the moral of the story is this: do not pass judgment ever on a person, but judge always. To judge the act or the state rather than the person is in itself an act of love. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.